B is, I'm supposed to tell you you're breaking in a new partner in on this.
Partner again?
Yeah, some cat he's on loan from Dope. Real burnout, on the ragged edge.
Oh, perfect.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Lethal Weapon Retrospective Series.
How are you, boys?
Join Garrett.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
Matt.
I'm surprised you haven't heard about me. You know, I got a bad reputation, and sometimes I just go nuts like now.
And Adam.
You're my family and my friends.
As they review all four films in the seminal Richard Donner-directed action franchise starring Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
I'm warning you.
Will Adam be able to recover after reviewing the entire Children of the Corn series?
God hates me, that's what it is.
Hate him back, it works for me.
Why did Matt want to do this series so bad?
You really are crazy.
And will Garrett still adore these films now, just as much as he did in his teens?
Come on, be original. Say yes, everyone else says no. Come on with me.
Find out the answers to these questions, as well as many more.
Do you really want to jump? Do you want to?
Coming up next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Well, we go on three.
Three on three.
One, two, and like
three.
Yeah? Okay. On three.
Three.
One.
Two. Three!
Lethal Weapon 4. Released July 10th, 1998. Budget was $150 million. Box office $285.4 million. And this is directed by the late Richard Donner. You know, I don't know about you, Matt. You were 5 years old at this time, but this was a huge day. The second weekend of July in 1998 in the lives of Garrett Collins and Adam Bunch, because we were there opening weekend, had to see it after we marathoned the first three. Back then thinking, oh, we had three really good films here. Adam, it's safe to say we were pretty excited, weren't we?
Hugely. I mean, it was just quote the trailers already before it went, quoting the old ones as we were getting ready. Yeah, could not have been more excited. We had sequelitis in a big bad way.
Now, that was how we saw it opening night, opening weekend. Matt, you caught this at the end of a marathon. How'd you see this the first time?
How you described it. I saw it in close proximity to the other ones. And I think this is only the second or third time I've watched it, period. So it was pretty new to me going back and watching it.
So, the making of this. Lethal Weapon 3, massive success. And Joel Silver was once again beaten down the door of Donner saying, let's get the band back together. But there's a few issues going on. Number one, Mel Gibson was now a big star and Oscar winner. And it took a while to get him to come on board. Yeah, him and Donner had done Conspiracy Theory. But initially, when pitching Braveheart, he went to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers turned him down. And I think he resented them, and I think it took a little bit more coaxing to get him involved.
Well, there's two things of note. Speaking of Gibson and Donner, they also did Maverick right after Lethal Weapon 3. And on press junkets for that movie, he said he was kind of indifferent to doing another Lethal Weapon movie. So I think right away that gave the signal that he would have to be coerced into making another one. And not just the Warner Brothers factor with Braveheart. He felt like it was kind of a, I don't want to call it a charity case, but Warner Brothers offered to pump $60 million into Braveheart if he agreed to make another Lethal Weapon. And he kind of took that as an insult. And in hindsight, he was kind of proven correct, because not only did Braveheart make a shitload of money at one Best Picture, it was a huge success. So Gibson didn't have to call Warner Brothers bluff. But I was surprised that, knowing what we know now with those two things, that he came back at all.
Same here. In fact, rumor has it that he told Donner, I'll come back only if it's a good script. Glad he got his wish. So yeah, so they started thumping around with doing another one right around summer of 93. Guy by the name of Jonathan Hensley, who had, at this point, hadn't written much, but he would go on to write Armageddon and a few other films. He did a treatment about a cop chasing bombs around the city, which Silver was thinking of picking up for this. Basically, what happened was 20th Century Fox was aiming for that to be Brandon Lee's next movie after The Crow. But of course, as we all know, Brandon Lee died on that set, and Fox would then just use it for the third Die Hard film. So basically, Die Hard 3 was almost going to be Lethal Weapon 4.
It's amazing how many of these stories we've been discussing lately about scripts and how they keep changing hands and changing characters. And it's not the last change this one goes through, even into production and filming. I guess not a huge surprise, because they were just kind of desperate to get this made, put on screen, and they were going to do it, because regardless of what it was going to spend to make it, it was going to make money.
Well, yeah, it was, because Lethal Weapon 3 was kind of the most profitable movie Warner Brothers had ever made up to that point, when you look at, you know, everything kind of evening out. And also, the Die Hard comparison is equally funny, because Gibson said something along the lines of, just send my scripts to Bruce Willis when it comes to the Lethal Weapon sequel. So, yeah, I mean, the stars would have aligned. I mean, both of these movies, I guess the other connection outside of that is they both involve foreign villains.
They then brought on a couple guys we have talked about in the last year, Alfred Goff and Miles Millar. They did a treatment, as did Jonathan Lemkin, who was brought in. He originally came up with an idea of, and this is such the late 90s, early 2000s, it was going to be all about the triads in China. You didn't watch one of these movies back then and have the Chinese be the villains without it being about triads, but that script was rejected. So after that script was done, Silver was like, fuck it, I'm just going to bring in Channing Gibson, who was a TV writer at this time. He did some touch-ups on it, but if you talk to anybody involved with this production, this thing was pretty much made up on the spot, and my God, if you watch this, you can so tell.
Well, there's also, they brought in Jeffrey Boehm to rewrite this script, because he was involved in various degrees on the other movies, and he was the one who wrote a script about fighting neo-Nazis for this one.
Which we talked about last week.
But he tried that again, and they turned it down because of the Oklahoma City bombings. They thought that was too close to home. But it's just amazing how many people touched this script. And as far as Channing Gibson goes, he must have suckered them in because they saw the last name.
That's what I thought, too. I had to check and make sure it wasn't a relative.
It's not like this guy wrote things like The X-Files or Twin Peaks, you know, great television. TV credits are pretty spotty, and his movie credits are even spottier, because after this he made another Jet Li movie, because what do you do with Jet Li now that he's in America? You pair him with DMX. And he made one of The Rock's early movies. I can't remember which one it was.
Was it The Rundown?
It's him and Johnny Knoxville. Oh, The Walking Tall.
Oh, shit. He did that.
Yeah, he wrote that. So nothing in this guy's track record leads me to believe that him matching Lethal Weapon. But on the part of Warner Brothers, because we have to talk about this, they needed a hit in the worst of ways. Because the year before this, a little movie called Batman and Robin came out. And not only did that kill a fourth movie that killed a franchise, it underperformed. And they also had The Avengers come out this year, which was a massive flop. They had Quest for Camelot, which also bombed, no pun intended. So this was kind of a desperate attempt for them to clear their checkbooks and bring some revenue in, because Warner Brothers was not doing well, because another person who fucked them over was Kevin Costner with The Postman, which came out the same year as Batman and Robin. I mean, I can't think of a worse double feature than Batman and Robin and The Postman.
When we did Lethal Weapon 2, and we talked about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, we talked about the fact that 1989 was a huge year for movies. You throw a rock at that calendar, and you'll hit a day where there was a good to great movie that had come out. 1997, 1998, it was pretty shoddy. Although it has Adam's favorite movie of all time, Gattaca.
Right, I mean, 97 was the year of Titanic.
That's true.
But you still had Lost World, you had Men in Black, you had a Bond movie, Face Off made a lot of money, Liar Liar. So there were some hits to be sure, but none of those were Warner Brothers properties. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at the 10 highest grossing films of 97, none of them were Warner Brothers.
And really, what they were gearing up with was the next year, when there was a lot that they had writing on a film that would be coming out after this, that we franchise we're going to be discussing in the future, about the future. But yeah, you're not kidding.
So initially, Leo Getz and Lee Butters was out of that script. And then they added Lee Butters, the Chris Rock character, as a gag detective, which they changed around. And then they brought in Joe Pesci to come in and work 3 weeks for a paycheck of $1 million. What a fucking gig.
Don must love just offering $1 million check.
Yeah.
Yeah. He should go to jail for stealing money. Although he got a Razzie nomination in return. But I can tell you the scene why.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Yeah, we'll get there. Mm-hmm. One more thing about the making of this that I want to talk about is, so they wrap up production. Like I said, the script was 3/4 done when they started this thing. They wrap it up in January of 98. This movie's supposed to come out in June, and they had a total of about 39 days when everything else was put in as far as effects and everything to edit this thing down, this is the definition of rushed. And Adam, you are one to say on these podcasts that when you rush these things, it 9 times out of 10 doesn't really come out that well. I mean, if we would have known that going in 1988, we would have probably said, fuck this and left, right?
Oh, yeah. There's no way we would have been nearly as excited. So I'll give them credit. Their promotional team and the way that they had people excited through the ads, through commercials. Once again, I'm going to talk about, you know, they had an opening scene that they had on, I don't know if it was Entertainment Tonight at that point. Maybe it was just E! News Weekly or something. But I remember the opening sequence was another one that, hey, tune in at 8 p.m. and we're going to show you the opening scene for the new Lethal Weapon movie. So they had beats that they were going to play again to get us into the theater. And hey, you know what? Back in 98, it worked.
And Donner added that scene at the last minute. That was something that was not in the original film. It was literally like, Donner was like, I need an opening scene to get people excited for this movie. So they literally shot that probably about 3 weeks before this thing went into editing.
Warner Brothers said, here's something we have from a superhero script lying around.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of people who brought it at the last minute, I have a theory that they called Shane Black to do Punch Up, and he told them to go fuck themselves and just call Fred Decker, see if he's busy.
No, no, no. Shane Black had nothing to do with this. He didn't want anything.
Fred Decker did, though.
Fred Decker had a little bit of thing, but he's not credited, and his contributions are very, 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 very minimal.
It's one big scene.
It's one scene, which we'll talk about.
The amazing part on this, and you mentioned it though, that the story credit is given to Alan Miles throughout. And it's just, I never knew that in advance, and I couldn't help but laugh knowing about the Richard Donner connection.
Oh yeah.
And good. Superman and what it would be.
Good call.
Well, was this their first big break, so to speak?
Yep. They've done some little things, TV, mm-hmm. but yeah, this really broke them out. And they've been working together ever since.
This movie comes out 11 years after the original, which, man, that makes the franchise a little long in the tooth. But when you have a franchise that has been around this long, you're about ready to do a new movie, what do? You bring in some new blood. And I remember, Adam, you and I were really excited to see what exactly they could do with Jet Li in this movie.
It was the one I was excited about, because you had heard about him, the trades from what they were, which, God, we were nerds reading trades back then. But they were just so high on this guy and how he was the Far East superstar, his first American role, first time playing this type of role. And that he was the new Jackie Chan is what I think they were billing him as. And we love Jackie Chan already. And he had a presence that we could not wait to see. But yeah, I mean, if anything else, even more so than Chris Rock, who was he was a git with that time. But it was really about Jet Li that seemed to be injecting some new blood.
Well, it's funny about Jet Li. They wanted Jackie Chan.
Yeah, they asked him first.
But he said he didn't want to play the villain.
And it took a lot of convincing from Donner to get Jet Li to come here, because he had the exact same reason, where I never play the villain. They had to really, really twist his arm a bit to get him to agree to this.
For him, this would be the one.
Oh, Christ.
Well, he also got, the condition was Joel Silver gave him a lead role in his next movie, which was the one with, was a singer, him and Aaliyah.
Romeo Must Die? Was that it?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Also, in a lot of ways, this movie destroyed the relationship between Richard Donner and Joel Silver, because around this time, during the filming of this movie, Joel Silver had moved into Richard Donner's office and basically kicked him out of the Warner Brothers building. And there has been some back and forth about how contentious that relationship is. But at this point, Matt, we were hearing a lot of stories about how Joel Silver was as a producer.
Yeah, I mean, well, his temper was getting more cantankerous than ever. Yeah. And also, if you look after this, he would still be producing a lot of movies. But if anything, it's like his input increased. As you look at his credits, his producing credits from like 48 Hours through this versus Matrix On, he produced a lot more stuff afterwards. I'm going to say that the Wachowskis probably bought him a lot of cocaine.
Yeah. Movie comes out, debuts at number one. It eventually grossed $130 million here in the U.S., which wasn't that high. The other ones, even last week's film, that movie stayed on top of the box office for about 3 or 4 weeks. This one went number one its first week and then kind of took a little bit, I don't want to say nosedive, but it sank pretty quickly.
Well, I think a lot of that's because the long week compared, the gap from 3 to 4 versus from 2 to 3,
oh, yeah,
is a lot more sizable. And I do think there was a certain amount on audiences' parts where they could see a certain amount of desperation, not its entirety, but I don't think the interest was there to garner a fourth one purely out of audience desire, especially because the third one open to mixed reviews. It made a lot of money, but I don't know anyone who thinks that's the best of the series, or even the best of the sequels, for that matter.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we have talked about the making of this. You guys ready to get into this plot summary? Because, man, do we have some plot going on here.
Yeah, you need like a map and compass to get through this plot and a Mad Libs. Do what they did on set with a Mad Libs booklet and inserting shit.
Or an Iron Man suit with a flamethrower, because that's what we're getting to start off. We're opening up. We have fire once again encompassing the screen, and it forms the number 4. As Riggs and Murtaugh, they head over to a guy in an armored suit setting everything on fire. Now, this scene, as I mentioned, it was the trailer scene. It was one that Donner ended up shooting pretty much weeks before the movie had come out. I remember, boys, when this had come out on video. I mentioned that I saw this in theaters with Adam, and then when it came out on video, there was a friend of mine. I was at his house, and he just got a new surround system, and he really, really wanted to put this movie on to show it off. And we pretty much watched this opening scene, and then went straight from that to Urban Legend, which is a whole nother story. But this starts us off like the bomb last week. This scene is not going to have anything to do with the plot. We're just kind of getting things going. They're going to mention very hastily the big things that are going on, which is that Riggs is going to be a dad and Murtaugh is going to be a granddad. So Matt, I guess it accomplishes that feat.
I guess, but let me lay one of my cards out on the table right now. I don't like the idea or the decision to have Riggs be a soon-to-be father. That feels really a very sizable stretch, even with his progression in the last couple of movies.
I mean, we got a cool, for me, music intro last time, playing over the credits. This one, like, it's a ball of fire, and then we go, and we're racing to this scene. This is the strangest opening, and you could almost tell that it was a necessity from script changes and shit that was left out or added, and they needed to explain it. Because it's these two in a car racing to a completely barren, empty, nobody in sight, downtown Los Angeles, where this crime is going on. This is some weird, strange setup. And I never minded it till I'm watching it for this and pay attention. This is some of the laziest backlot looking shooting that I've seen, especially in this kind of movie. This is pretty shitty for a setup.
Well, I guarantee this was an insert scene done after principal shooting, just because of how to call this movie scattershot is an insult to people who can't shoot straight. This script feels like there were 10 people walking down a hallway. They were all looking at their phones. They smacked into each other. Everyone's papers flew up in the air, and they reassembled them all into one big pile in no discernible order. So there's 10 different plots, and they're all going in and out based on what page you're at.
Riggs asks if this guy's from the NRA and suggests running him over, and any questions we had about whether or not this wouldn't be leaning toward a comedic sensibility are answered right off the bat.
Yep, this one is one eye poke away from fully being a Three Stooges movie. I mean, that's the trajectory of this series. They've gotten progressively more comedic, but in the case of Three, that really led to some tonal whiplash. This one doesn't have any whiplash because it is borderline just a straight-up comedy for most of it.
Sitcom. This is a sitcom from the beginning all the way through.
This might as well called All in the Lethal Weapon Family.
All in the Lethal Family. So they act surprised when gunfire bounces off this guy, and they are trying to figure out who's going to distract him. And it's here when Murtaugh reveals to Riggs that he's going to be a father. And then Riggs, he reveals that Rianne is pregnant and Murtaugh's going to be a grandfather.
What?
Murtaugh says that she can't be pregnant as she's not married. As, by the way, more shots ring out and Van Halen is put on by this guy. Riggs suggests to Murtaugh that he take off his clothes and cluck like a chicken to distract him. So Murtaugh reveals underwear with hearts, and Riggs says to go on too. Murtaugh does what he says as Riggs fires a perfect shot that sends the guy into a gas station, making it explode, and they run from the explosion. Boys, what the hell did I just read? Here's my issue. It's a lot of issues, but we never hear what this guy is. Is he part of Al-Qaeda? Is he just some guy who's drunk and trying to cause destruction? What exactly is this guy trying to accomplish by setting fire to things like this?
He's Firefly. This has got to be something left over from some bad Batman script that just was sitting in a desk somewhere. This doesn't fit this kind of movie. This doesn't fit the rest of the movie. And it doesn't make sense of how this thing starts. I don't get it. I really don't. And the cover-up that they're using of, you know, the dark, rainy night to cover up how shitty this is even shot is just, I guess you had to give it, start it with a bang, but poor decision.
I get the sense Joel Silver was coked out of his mind watching Batman and Robin and said, hey, this movie's got an ice villain. My movie needs to have a fire villain.
But he's not even a villain. He just disappears after this. We don't even get a scene of him being let out in the gas station. Nothing. You know,
yeah, Captain Murphy should be replaced by Commissioner Gordon and say, there's a new villain, Riggs and Murtaugh. You have to go fight him.
If there's one thing I will compliment the scene on, I will say I do like that we are once again reminded that Riggs is a good shot. He's a perfect shot. And he has to have a perfect shot to hit this guy in the back and make the explosion that he does. So I do like that they're bringing that back. But at the same time, again, clucking around like a chicken just so that Riggs can once again reveal that he's just fucking with them. It's just stupid.
I would care about that if I felt like this was actually referencing that sniper Vietnam type stuff that we had discussed. All it feels like is it's Mel Gibson in an action. It's crazy that this is, as you said, 11 years from the first one, because it feels like it's been 11 years since 3. I feel like this is one of those legacy sequels between 3 and 4. It feels like everything aged that far. It's ridiculous. It's only was, what, 3 years? And fuck, it feels longer.
It's actually 6 years after...
Yeah, because that was 92.
Yeah, 92.
This is 92. You're right. Okay, so it's long for a sequel, but man.
You're right, though. It does feel longer. So
the only positive I'll say is he cut that stupid mullet finally.
Yes, that was cool. I did like that as well. Riggs then says that he doesn't think the bird thing helped. He just wanted to see Murtaugh do it. And then he says that he'll buy Murtaugh a donut. Riggs, Murtaugh, and Leo, once again, talking about hair, at least Leo dyed his hair back, right, Matt? He's not blonde anymore.
Oh, yeah, and he got rid of the earring, too, I think.
Yeah, they're out on Murtaugh's boat fishing. Adam, am I the only one who thought of Gone Fishing with Glover and Pesci during this scene?
Oh, wow. Yes, you are the only one. What kind of smash cut do we go from that weird incest first one to now the nighttime shoot at the Universal Studios pool in the back lot?
Yeah.
This, I remember this kind of. I didn't remember just how bad this is inserted here. You got your opening, you have this. They don't connect. It's random. There's no setup. We're just suddenly on a boat. We don't even see him catch a shark that is just sitting there in the boat. It's just there, and it looks bad. You could tell they're floating in a pool somewhere, and it's just nighttime with no lighting rigs. This is some shitty filmmaking. It's amazing, though, because really soon, we're like 20 minutes into this film, and nothing has happened yet.
Oh, this movie takes a good 40 minutes for anything of substance to happen.
Adam, how many times have you watched this since you and I saw this in theaters?
I would say probably twice. Definitely not a bunch. I mean, 1 and 2, absolutely regularly. 3, seen a decent number of times. But in the 25 years since this has come out, yeah, I'd say 3, maybe. It's been at least 15 years.
Murtaugh and Riggs, they talk about their different baby situations, and Riggs reveals that his last wife died because he was a cop, yet he's not sure if he's finished with the force. And then Leo goes off about different boat terms. Riggs says that he hasn't talked to Lorna about getting married, and they stop Leo from shooting Jaws. We then see a ship pretty much coming out of nowhere, drive right past them. They chase
him. Yeah, suddenly, by the way, you talk about inconsistencies. Suddenly, this pool of water is 10 times bigger than it was the previous shot.
I'm amazed that clearly the Chinese have fucking Klingon bird of prey stealth technology for this boat to just be upon them with no sound whatsoever.
No sound at all. They chase it a bit before they're getting shot at, and they fire back and cause a fire on the ship. Riggs climbs aboard the ship as Leo and Murtaugh argue. The ship then kind of stops as Riggs is getting shot at, and a barrel which is on fire lands right on Roger's new boat.
The ship stops because the ship changes size like 4 times depending on how they're shooting the sea. It's a freighter, and then it's like kind of a commercial fisher boat, and then it's not. I couldn't believe
what is just happening.
Watching the inconsistency for the shots.
We then see a rubber shark that Rennie Harlan would have been proud of. It swims right up to Roger as Riggs continues to fight on the ship. Riggs stops and opens a compartment to see a ton of Asian refugees. We then see the villains of the movie, aided by what we think is the muscle, Jet Li. And as I mentioned, this was a huge draw for Adam and I. We had been reading about his coming from Asian cinema to the States for months. And Donner and company, they were very excited to bring him on board. Still, even with Li being here, I have an affinity to Busey's Big Joshua. And I don't think this character, as far as muscle goes, can hold a candle to that villain. Yet, it's the closest they've gotten since the first one. And my God, is he fucking fast. I did not realize boys, just how fast Jet Li was back in the late 90s. Just quicker than a hiccup, as Jim Ross would say. Adam, how do you feel about Jet Li in this?
I actually like him a lot. I've never really liked the monk warrior thing. I don't dig that. I think that is almost offensively stereotypical, but I like Jet Li as a presence, huge. I like Mr. Joshua, but almost comic-y. He's just so over the top that, that I have fun with it. But I think Jet Li is about the only time that I've actually felt someone is dangerous. And that's even with Mel Gibson and really looking too old for this shit as he's fighting his way through the boat. But Jet Li, I get a sense of danger and potential every time, even when he's just standing still.
That was the big question to me, was how are they going to make Mel Gibson look like he even has a chance against Jet Li? Because Gibson at this point, I believe he's playing someone who's 42 at this point, 11 years after the last film. So yeah, he'd be 41, 42, his character anyway. That was a big question. I think you and I used to talk about that a lot, was are they going to make Mel Gibson kill this guy? Or is Jet Li going to have to negotiate the fact that he's going to request that it's going to be 2-on-1, and spoiler alert, Mel Gibson's not the one who kills him. It's Danny Glover who does later.
Yeah, even though it's 2-on-1, I still feel like it needed to be 10-1.
Oh, of course.
You know, believe that somebody would have killed him. Mm-hmm. I think he's good. If anything, he's the only fresh addition, because everything else in this movie feels largely stale. So he's kind of that spice that peppers things up. I mean, he's probably the second best villain by default, but a lot of that's just because of how bad the villain was in 3, that anything would have been a step up. I will say that I respect the fact that they didn't feel the need to either dub him with an American actor or have him say a lot of dialogue in broken English. They played to his strengths for his first movie. Yeah, Donner even told him to slow down for some of his takes because he was moving too fast for the cameras to pick him up.
And some they slow down. You could tell later on some fights they actually slow camera down.
We cut to this guy who he had been meeting with our villains previously. And I mean, if you have a guy this high up in the government, why are you going to push him in the way of an oncoming train? And why are you having Jet Li, of all people, this formidable, huge star martial artist, get behind the wheel of a car and push him in the way of a train? I know this is setting up what we're going to see later, but I found this just silly.
Yeah, I guess you're right. There's certain things they have him do where it feels like you're also not using the full capacity of what you have. Because Jet Li is literally a lethal weapon in real life.
Exactly.
What kind of coincidence? Are they just staking out this intersection that this train dangerously goes by, waiting and hoping that somebody fucking drives up to the eyes being down? Shit. Yep.
We cut to Riggs and Murtaugh getting the lowdown of the ship that they discovered, and the comparison to slaves is being made. Leo is given an interview to a news division, and this is when we hear about and then meet Butters, played by Chris Rock. Now, Chris Rock was very wide-eyed, and by the way, when shit started coming out about Mel Gibson, Chris Rock was one of the first to defend him, saying, well, Mel Gibson actually, he fought for me to get the role in Lethal Weapon 4. He kind of gave me my big cinematic break. At this point, he had been on Saturday Night Live. I was a fan of him on that, but this was a pretty big role for him. How do we feel about Chris Rock in this movie?
You know, at this point, I believe I had, and I think I mentioned it before, I had the Bigger and Blacker CD, so if I just wanted to listen to him do stand-up for 2 hours, I could put it in and listen to it. That's all he does here. He does bits that I've heard, and I can't believe that. He's literally retelling bits of his stand-up for a lot of his jokes. If you're going to do this, this isn't the guy to do it. He just stands out so much. He can't wear a suit. He looks like a little kid wearing his dad's suit throughout this fucking movie. Nothing fits him right. And then all it is he's trying to one-up Pesci, and Pesci's trying to one-up Rock. And they're both annoying as fuck from beginning to end of this film.
I hate Chris Rock in this movie so much. You already have Joe Pesci. Why are you compounding an already comedic movie that has a character designed only for comic relief by creating a second character to use the same purpose? And more importantly, this feels like the studio trying to get young kids to go see this movie to get a hip comedian with Chris Rock.
Mm-hmm.
He's borderline interminable, but I have this problem with a lot of Chris Rock movies, like Dogma. Everything Adam said, I think, applies in that movie, where he's basically just doing stand-up. And I think he's a great stand-up comedian, but I also don't like even though they got rid of the obvious homosexuality, there is still that gay panic type of humor in this, and I resent that for obvious reasons. So I hate everything with him.
Some of those gay panic scenes, like, they're shot, and because he was added later, they're kept in, and then they're written around because the coverage was already shot with Glover and some of that kind of stuff. So it's the way that this thing is cut to edit him into the film is just really haphazard.
Let's not forget he was originally written as a gay character anyway, so it's all so fucking muddy.
I'm not going to say I blame him.
No.
You know, because when you get this chance at his age, it's amazing how you think about it, because he looks the same, he acts the same. Good on him. But there's nobody who wouldn't jump at this opportunity. Back then, I love the credit he gave Mel Gibson for being like, look, man, this guy pushed for me. He helped me buy a house. He helped me get paid. I don't blame him for it. I just think it's a really bad decision. And yeah, Matt nailed it, I think. It was the studio being like, we got to get this to get in these urban utes into our film.
And to also give Rihanna reason to have a kid. Because, forget, that's his other part of this film.
Yeah, because let's double down on the kid for no discernible reason other than the final shot of this film.
Oh, my God. So Butter starts yelling at a corpse and talks about how gangbangers being shot doesn't compare to what they're dealing with here. And then Riggs says that Butters is a little overzealous. And then he apologizes about Roger's boat. Roger gets on his boat and notices more refugees hiding in it. More on this later, boys. We cut to Riggs getting home as he tells Lorna that he's late because he had some bad Chinese. Really bad, just low-rent racist humor there. And calls her a little knocked up. You know, we're going to tear this movie apart, I know, for another hour or so. But I will say, if there's one thing that surprised me in my rewatch of this, it's how much I did like the dynamic between Riggs and Lorna, and Riggs trying to decide whether to marry her or not, given what he went through with his last wife and that whole switch in his head. I think if we had built on that a little bit more, I think it could have been more powerful, but I do like that dynamic.
And I was surprised because going into it, I'm like, oh, that's right. They make Lorna literally barefoot and pregnant was what I remembered. And they don't. She is barefoot and pregnant, but they give her more to do kind of in the movie later on. I do think there is a decent drama story to be told on Riggs' half and on Murtaugh's half. But you got to look for it, because the few moments that it happened, it brightens up this film and makes it considerably better than the other parts. They got good chemistry together. It's amazing how, you know, he looks 20 years older in these 6 years. She looks the same. And they kept the trailer. Weird little stuff. I'm noticing parts here and there. Yeah, there's something to be done here. But it doesn't want to spend the time to do it because it's got to go back to slapsticky Chris Rock and the random Joe Pesci and still try to be relevant with a social commentary on human trafficking. And it can't please all the masters that it wants to.
Yeah, it's got way too much on its mind that feels like it doesn't have to occupy any space to this, which is the most interesting point of comparison in the movie is with him and Murtaugh. I think there is something there, especially because for all intents and purposes, this was going to be the last movie in all likelihood. We'll talk about the possibility at the end of this show, but outside of that, it kind of comes and goes, so it's hard to get that invested in it.
So Riggs explains his night as he then discovers a nursery that Lorna's been working on. He brings up marriage, and Lorna says the reason she hadn't is because she figured he didn't want to. And then Riggs discovers a book by Ebony Clark. More on this later. Lorna says that she was talking to Internal Affairs and they said that Murtaugh is on the take, as they say, and begs him not to tell Roger about some news because he's got enough problems. And after Riggs kind of elbows her a bit and tries to get it out of her, she tells him that Butters is the father of Roger's grandbaby. Of course, we know that Riggs isn't going to say anything to him. This just seems like a reason to like give these guys the dynamic that we've seen before where, Matt, you pointed this out to me earlier in the retrospective, and I didn't really think about it until I was editing the show, but you're absolutely right. Riggs does a lot of poking around on Murtaugh. He does a lot of fucking with him, and this is just seems like an excuse to kind of do that.
Yeah, and we also have to contrive a reason for Chris Rock to actually be here.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same reason that they had to contrive Joe Pesci to be in the second movie. Well, he's tied into the story as flimsy and I would argue as ridiculous as it is, because we've never seen this character before, and we've been pretty acclimated to the police force. So it's amazing that they were able to keep this relationship as secretive as they could, given they worked together, and he goes home to the daughter every single night.
Is anybody ever going to think Roger's on the take? I mean, at any point did anybody think that? No. The rest of this is just, we've cobbled together so many things, and I don't know, maybe there needs to be a three-hour version to flesh out all the shit that got edited, but as it is, the right hand and the left don't talk.
Do we even care about...
No, and there's nothing that in this movie would give the notion of cops being on the take or potentially being involved in the trafficking.
Oh, was that leftover from last week's film that we discussed?
God, it was.
It doesn't make any sense. especially, look, I'm glad that Lorna still has involvement with IA. She's literally not, okay, I got together with a rig, so I quit being a cop, you know, that fucking trope. But to be like, oh, they think Roger's on the tip, and it doesn't go anywhere. So it's kind of stupid that way.
At least they didn't nuke her, which was what I was terrified they were going to do.
Yeah, she easily could have been the woman in the fridge.
Yeah, there's no fridging, although she gets as much to do as Natalie Portman got in that last Star Wars movie. Same purpose, too.
They pull up to Roger's house, and then they discuss possible names for their kids. As Riggs discovers a Chinese kid peeking from the kitchen, Riggs warns Roger that this is illegal, and Roger says that he sees it as him freeing slaves like his ancestors. Oh, boy.
Jeez. This series has always leaned into important political stuff. It has never been that lazy with being on the nose.
More importantly, do not try to make social statements when you have 20 writers. It doesn't come from a singular voice, so it's going to ring as hollow.
I remember there was a lot of talk about this at the time. You open up a newspaper and you would see some human trafficking articles, things about this kind of stuff happening. I feel like at one point, Donner just kind of opened up a newspaper, saw an article about it, and said, I need to put that in our next Lethal Weapon movie. Why Gibson would look at a script like that and say, yeah, let's go ahead and do that movie, I have no idea. But this, you guys are absolutely right, it has no business being here.
Is a big industry, and I hate using that term, but it is a big industry in Southern California, LA, San Diego area. So this exists, period. It exists to this day. The trafficking and the indentured servitude that they get put on the, I don't call them coyotes when they come from Asia, but I can't remember the term anymore. It's disgusting. It's disturbing. Where I live, they shut down 3 buffet restaurants because people were living on site because they were brought over here working off their debt. So this shit exists. There's something to be told here, but it's done very poorly.
Well, so much so that that idea has permeated a lot of movies that came after this. I mean, two of the most infamous, or I should say two of the better movies that use that are the first Taken movie, and Man on Fire does that.
You know what I noticed, too, is the lack of Jan de Bont on this film. This movie just kind of looks like a TV show. It's a different shot
movie. It doesn't look good.
No.
Well, I swear to God, this was part of the deal to get Jet Li, because the DP on this is the one who directed Romeo Must Die and Cradle to the Grave.
Yeah, maybe.
And one of my favorite video game movies of all time, because it's awful. Well, actually, two of them. Doom and Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li.
Jesus Christ. Roger sends his kids off with some money, and Riggs asks if they got a raise that he didn't know about. Trish walks down the stairs before Rian comes home, and Riggs warns the Chinese kid to stay away from his girl. We have more of the Force teasing Roger as the picture of him in his underwear is posted, and the captain says that times are changing. Here's another big plot contrivance, boys, that I had to pause the movie. I was laughing so hard at it. We hear that the insurance didn't re-up. So the fact that they are on the streets and they are destroying them means that the insurance isn't going to re-up. So what's the captain do? He fucking promotes them.
Not only do they get promoted, but they're demoted at the end of the movie. And in doing so, in this movie, after their promotion, they cause more property damage than they have in the previous 3 movies combined.
This is so stupid.
This seems to be left from some different script.
Yes.
It doesn't play in this film. Though I'll say, when the captain's talking about looking over and seeing kids and he doesn't recognize their names or what they're saying, I feel you. I feel you right.
They didn't reassure the captain that they're going to stay out of trouble. We then get some gay undertones shine through as Roger suspects Butters really likes him, and Riggs says that it might be possible. Riggs runs down the cop shrink to ask her about the possibility that he can marry again, and then we see more rookies, and we hear about Uncle Benny and his new nightclub. So they start asking Butters about Vinny Chan and invite him in on the case, and we get a car ride with the three of them as they discover Leo is following them, one of Adam's favorite scenes, I'm sure. He says that he's been perfecting the tailing technique as a PI, and we get an argument between Butters and Leo, where Leo is called a leprechaun.
So this guy went from money launderer to realtor to private investigator. He is truly the Fletch of the Lethal Weapon series.
They head to Uncle Benny's and ask how the front is, and then we hear this, "Fried rice, you pick," after interrogating Benny a bit. Riggs comes face to face with Lee for the first time, even humming the good, the bad, and the ugly right in his face.
I have not seen just so much constant inappropriate racial jokes since the end of A Christmas Story. I mean, Jesus.
The fact that Rush Hour is more racially sensitive than this movie. just blows my mind.
Same year, too.
I know, that's why I was talking about.
This is Chinatown, but I don't know. Maybe this is Vancouver Chinatown. It sure is not Los Angeles Chinatown. I don't know what they were thinking of this place. This is not what it's like at all.
Well, not only that,
we talked about those first few movies. It felt like L.A.
Not only that, shooting in any Chinatown is not that exciting. There's not much to do. When we get some action scenes later and some running around and chasing, there's nothing to do. It's a boring place to shoot anyway. So Benny insists that they leave and Riggs just busts through a glass window. And then Lee says that in Hong Kong, you'd be dead before Riggs sets off the sprinklers. They are then pursued and we get our Riggs running scene, which is, as I mentioned, very boring. He bursts through traffic as Roger hops on a bike. He climbs a staircase to pursue them while they're in an elevator. The guy hops down and Riggs pursues them more. And Chris Rock is so useless here, though he does arrest one of them while at the same time uttering a Johnny Cochran joke. Boys, you agree with me? This is pretty boring, right?
Yeah, it's boring. It's not good action. The only thing that made me laugh is he's going to drop on three. They bring back the joke one, and he's just like, to hell with it, and just drops anyway on two. You know, if we hadn't watched these in rapid succession, I don't know if I'd get it or laugh. But this is, it's boring. It's not very exciting. The only thing they did was not run through like a fortune cookie factory. They did everything but that. It's just fucking, hey, fuck. I did not hate it when we originally saw it like this. This has aged really, really poorly.
It has. In fact, you and I came out pretty high on this movie when we saw it initially. We kind of liked it when we saw it. When we get to Blade, we're going to have discussions because you and I were on different ends on that one. But that'll be in the next couple years.
I feel like I'm being browbeaten by the racial components of this. Not just with the literalization of comparing it to actual slavery from the black perspective, but just the way the jokes are. I mean, like I said, the fact that Rush Hour feels more sincere than this movie is kind of mind-blowing. And this action scene just feels like dumb noise. This is a textbook padding sequence, because much like the hockey sequence in the third one, really nothing of substance comes from this part.
Because even the person that Butters arrests isn't somebody who should have been arrested. He was just a random waiter that went running.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing pays off.
We get a little parkour here as Riggs hops some buildings, but he eventually gets stuck. So Roger sets up a dumpster for him to jump into. Riggs interrogates the guy's partner, who says that he's the waiter at the restaurant, as Adam just mentioned. Turns out, all he was doing was trying to rehash the entire menu. Meanwhile, the other guy gets taken out by Lee in the film's first martial arts sequence. Roger,
can I also say, for the record, this movie feels the most sanitized from a violence level. I'm shocked this movie is not PG-13.
Reason for this to be R. Other than a few F-bombs, there's no R.
We do get some F-bombs, and there's some squibs later. There's some blood spurted later, but you're right. It does seem like the most tame. Meanwhile, Roger introduces the head of the refugees. We'll know him as Mr. Hong, who's the head of the Hong family. So does that make him Hong Hong? He introduces him to Tequila, and they have a toast. Roger asks him about Benny, who's apparently an artist in China. And Roger finds out that Hong is a grandfather as well, and Roger gives him his father's watch. Why?
Because Pulp Fiction did this 4 years prior.
God. It's like, doesn't, why don't you just play, like, paint a fucking X on his chest?
He's not drunk enough to do this. With this watch, I don't remember being brought up in the previous films, but it matters now. You make this about a drama about these two fathers and families, I think you have something really good to be worth watching here. The little bit that you get out of these two, I'm enjoying.
I agree with
that. It's dropped. It's gone. But you make this about, is Riggs and Lorna going to become a family? Is Roger missing part of his family while Mr. Hong is trying to get back with his family? You make this a drama action with a little bit of comedy as opposed to this sitcom bullshit. You got something strong, because I like this Roger and the dad. Then it's gone.
You're saying they should have made a movie like the first one.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Make it like the first one.
We then cut to the weirdest scene of the movie. We have this prison in China as a plane comes to pick up a few of these guys. This came out of nowhere.
I didn't know that in the middle of this, I was going to watch the opening to the first X-Men film, where suddenly I'm watching soldiers marching in the pouring rain. What the fuck?
I was like, oh, this is deleted footage from Con Air.
I thought of Con Air too. We then cut to Riggs in a boxing match as he falls and injures his shoulder, or so we think. Riggs says that the kid might be good, but the fact that he couldn't catch the guy from the day before, as well as not hang with his opponent, means that, guess what? He's getting too old for this shit. Roger says that you can't beat the clock, so you might as well accept it.
This scene in the locker room, you have this random giant looking bodybuilder. Yeah. Keep walking back and forth behind them.
I know.
He just stands out so much.
It is when they get comfortable and Roger is almost naked that Butters walks right in. So, of course.
Yep.
Leo says that he's working on a good PI case, which has to do with a dog. Butters says the guy Riggs couldn't catch had a gun that matched the one that shot at them from the boat. He then says that the guy was found strangled on a building. And we hear how they fuck you with the cell phones. Oh my god. We reamed on last week's bringing up the this joke again, but this time it is just painful, guys. This is painful.
Comedy is done in threes because then it comes back and it works the third time. Not this. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, this is painful. And then Chris Rock doing his giant phone bit that he did from one of his early specials. And my mama, she had this phone that was so big, you had to like get it all the way around. One, two.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard that in three different specials because he retells the same fucking jokes anymore. And so to hear it back this as well, oh, this scene is painful.
Well, this is also the post. Now that Robin Williams and Jim Carrey were huge stars, everybody thought they could do improv.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if they just set up a camera and set riff for a bit.
Well, you know what? It's funny you mentioned that. I was actually watching the commentary for this, which means I watched this movie twice, boys. And Donner does bring that up. There were points when he would set up three or four cameras, like a sitcom, and just let these guys go at it just like this. So you hit it right on the head, Adam, exactly how he filmed a lot of this film. Riggs then prank calls Leo after all this, and then he brings Roger the idea of actually hiring Leo. Roger heads home to change his shirt because he spilled coffee on it. They pull up to the house and see that their loved ones are once again being held hostage. Riggs compliments Jet Li on his pajamas before a fight breaks out, and it takes a while, but Lee finally gets in on the action and starts wailing on Riggs, and we then have a brief Mexican standoff before Lee fights his way out of it. They tie everyone up, and wouldn't you know it, we have another fire in a Lethal Weapon film. But you know what? I do like this scene. I think it's harrowing. I think the fact that they're stuck here and they can't breathe in the fire, not to mention the fact that they're pregnant, it does create a little bit of drama here.
I think it's the standout action beat of the movie. This is the one that really gives Jet Li some time to shine. For the first time, we see him full off, especially against more than one person. It's a badass final moment as he strips the guns. It's something that we see get ripped off later in so many films, mm-hmm. but I think this is the first time that I saw it, and it looks fucking cool. It's a pretty cool scene, and I just got to say, this poor Murtaugh family and this poor Murtaugh house. This house has suffered more than we have watching this film.
I don't know about that.
I want to know what the insurance payments are like on this house.
No shit.
This is the only time in the movie where I feel like anyone's in any semblance of danger. After this, like the action, all the other action sequences, they might as well be made out of rubber.
And even when, you know, we have Lorna walking in a room, and then Jet Li does that thing where he brings his leg up so high that he kicks her behind him. Just fantastic. Who saves the day? This little boy, Ping. He comes in with some scissors and cuts them to safety as they escape. Riggs and Murtaugh, they head off in pursuit. Riggs calls for some help, and they get in a car chase. They get behind this trailer, and Riggs hops on a house on wheels. There's some plastic everywhere, and Riggs interrogates one of them. More drive in to pursue, and I have to say, boys, I do like this plastic being everywhere. It creates some good tension. This is an action scene unlike any I've ever seen. I do like this action scene in this film.
It's a fun throwback to the second movie with the plastic on the house, but you know what movie ripped this off and I would say did it better is there's a fight scene in Fast and Furious 7.
Oh, for God's sake.
Where Paul Walker fights, what's that guy's name? The Asian guy. Not Han. Oh, Tony Jaa. And they're in like a trailer that's on the back of the convoy. It's very similar to that, but my problem with this is Riggs is starting to get to the point where he gets progressively more superhuman as these movies go on. Now, granted, he's not to the level of like John McClane when he got to his fourth movie, but I am starting to feel some of the reality from that first movie and even the second one stripped away entirely.
Well, I like it, but all I can see is that we're back to a house under construction. You know?
Oh, yeah.
This series loves fighting in a house under construction. We saw it in every film so far. So it's cool, but I do think it also goes on a little too long, and I think I've seen this freeway being used in action scenes a few too many times at this point.
I love the guy getting hit by the bus. I thought that was awesome. And we see Riggs, he's getting dragged as he throws a table leg at the car after him. And Riggs once again gets in Roger's car, and they once again go after the other thug. They get side by side with him before launching themselves through an office building. Roger's car is once again beat to shit, and they have no choice but to end the chase.
Yep, so this is the scene that Fred Decker came up with.
Yep.
And the most implausible thing is this movie is that that office building is completely empty.
Right.
You know good and well somebody would be staying there late, or they would have gotten early. Somebody would have died in this part. Like, apparently it's the same building that goes down in Man of Steel that gets evacuated before goes down. Not Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, where it's like, oh, we went to the island and it's uninhabited. Don't worry, everybody. No, it's the building from the third one where they evacuated.
Yeah.
I'm like, you mean to tell me there's not one person still in there?
It's every Marvel movie. It's, yeah. They called ahead of time and cleared it out.
Sokovia, everyone get out.
They see the sign that says that they are too close, which of course reminded me of Jurassic Park, which came out a few years before. Lee asks for more time to get money for their release before finding his brother and telling him that money here in the States changes everything. When he said brother to this guy, I thought maybe he was just calling him like his bro. I didn't realize it was his actual brother until later on in the film.
He looked nothing alike.
I know!
I don't even think they're both the same ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Just because they're Asian does not make them countrymen. They're not. Though I had to laugh when I saw them going into customs area, because all I'm thinking is they're going into this place and it's like protected. I'm like, diplomatic immunity. I wish we were that smart.
What they do with this. Oh my God. We're almost there. We cut back to the Murtaugh household, and Riggs checks on Ping as Butters pulls up, and Roger introduces him to his family, or so he thinks. Leo, he's back in the story as he calls to say that Benny is at the dentist, and it is on the way to the dentist that Butters tries telling Roger what is really going on, and again, we get more gay jokes, and unsurprisingly, Riggs can't get enough of it.
The one part that is a running gag, because they stay with it the entire length of the film, is that Mel Gibson never calls him Butters. Every single time he mentions his name, it's a different word that is similar to Butters, and he never calls him Butters.
I thought he did towards the end.
Maybe at the very end he does, but he name checks him a bunch, and it's almost never Butters.
All right, boys, let's get to a great scene. So meanwhile, Leo is in pain at the dentist, and Riggs comes in as Benny is getting drilled, saying it's only a drill, and we get the laughing gas, and this is past the cusp of just being ridiculous. Just a stupid way of revealing the villain, not to mention who Butters really is to our heroes. This has improv written all over it.
And it goes on.
Yes! And on. Adam, I think even you and I were cringing at the scene when we saw it in theaters.
Yeah. Nothing is edited down in this film. All these scenes, which are already bad, the length of them just compound it so much worse.
But you know what? I remember the theater we were in loving this. They were rolling as this was going on. And you and I were just kind of looking at each other like, okay. Just kind of shrugging our shoulders.
I wish Leo would get out of here.
Roger punches Riggs for keeping Butters' identity a secret as we see some counterfeit money being made. We're hearing about people's money, and then we hear that Lee is part of the Chinese triad as the money is verified, and Uncle Benny is also taken out. So the big bad of the movie, we think it's Uncle Benny who's behind it all, but Matt, no, it's actually Jet Li who's the head of it. I think that's a good idea to do. I just hate the fact that this guy can't get his own money. He has to make it.
Yeah, he's forced to print his own money. And also, this reveal should have happened when he shows up at the house.
Yes. And more lazy writing. Riggs and Lorna, they talk more about marriage as they pull up to a train stop. And as this is being talked about, as well as them feeling the baby kick for the first time, we see Riggs' car getting pushed into the line of an oncoming train. And unlike the guy earlier, Riggs is actually smart here. He just pulls forward and the train goes past them. Roger calls to say that he found his watch. They discover the funny money, and this guy who has all the answers. We haven't mentioned this guy yet, Matt. You and I, we love making fun of these characters who come into these films and they know everything. There's this Asian cop in the precinct here who knows every single plot point before it happens.
Yeah, he must have read all 20 scripts.
One of those he battered.
Yeah. He puts together that four fathers actually means the number four. So Riggs then says that he was just starting to like the old goat, Uncle Benny, as Roger uncovers Hong. And then we hear more about the corrupt Chinese general. Meanwhile, the cops pull up to where the gang is, and we get a lot of shit-talking from Riggs as he tells them their counterfeit money is worthless here. A gunfight breaks out as Riggs tells Roger to keep his head down and let them shoot each other. Butters takes a few out, and then Riggs asks about Roger having all the money he has, and this is when we hear that Roger is actually boinking Ebony Clark. You can't have a reaction.
It's a movie that I can get mad at. It's not that point. It just feels like, I think uninspired is overly inspired, overstimulated, because there's so much that they want to do, but none of it's hitting.
I will say, you know what I didn't remember was the fact that Butters actually gets involved in this. He's taking quite a few of these guys out. But when you have the younger character, I guess that's what you do.
Yeah. It just means that they hadn't filmed this part of the movie when they decided to add him to the cast list. Right. Yet, so give him something to do.
We see Lee taking out a few more guys as another gets shot up as he's driving away. Butters gets shot as Roger finally gets his name right.
This is why you aim for the head.
Yep. Riggs pulls up with a forklift and gets kicked in the face for his troubles. And I'll say I do like this fight. I like the brawling style of Riggs against Lee's smooth style. But it's when his brother is taken out by Murtaugh that we have some unexpected emotion going on here.
Which I like. It's amazing that you got so many accomplished actors, and it's Jet Li, who's silent for 90% of the time we see him, who's actually bringing something to it.
Yeah, but as you mentioned, he doesn't even look like him. Brother from another mother, I guess.
Yeah, this is like a Face-Off, where you tried to convince me that Nick Cage and Alessandro Nivola are brothers.
Roger tells Riggs that he's not worth dying for before he starts walking toward them. Murtaugh says that they should go ask him how he took Riggs' gun apart the way he did. And here's our final fight. So it's 2-1 here, which Lee is winning very easily. I do like the white outfit because the blood shows up really well on it. Roger's taken down, and here's Riggs taking Lee on and not faring much better. But he gets some shots in before Lee comes in and chokes him out. But Roger's right there and shoves a rebar right through him, which Riggs twists and turns in his body, but they lean a little too hard and then fall right into the water.
So I have to call a spade a spade. They stole this from another action movie from the 90s. Did you guys ever see a little movie called Patriot Games? At the end of that movie, Harrison Ford as Jack Ryan impales Sean Bean on a boat, and then the boat explodes.
Yeah, but that's like saying them shooting at each other is ripping off Die Hard. I mean, how many times?
And it's the fact that it's in the rain, too. Like, it's just fighting another foreign villain.
Lee has the upper hand underwater before Riggs conveniently finds a machine gun right next to him, an Uzi, and takes Lee out. Because the bullets would work underwater, too.
He installed the cheat code to find an Uzi underwater. That's the equivalent of in a Resident Evil game when you're walking around a deserted mansion and you find a clip of shotgun ammo.
Riggs pulls himself out of the water and sees Roger not moving before the structure crumbles and Riggs is trapped underwater. Roger yells for Riggs and somehow, some way, I'm not sure if he has the shine or not, but he says that he hears Riggs and jumps into the water to save him. He swims right up to Riggs' body and they count to 3 underwater before Roger is able to somehow pull the structure off and pull Riggs to safety. As they surface, Riggs asks Roger what took him so long.
I still think it's ridiculous having Jet Li lose to these two guys. I know there's guns involved, but still.
Yeah, I don't like him losing. I will say I enjoy the fight. I enjoyed it then. It was a different type of action. Yes, there had been some movies, absolutely. I understand that, which is why the Enter the Drag Queen joke earlier kind of makes me cringe. But I love seeing Jet Li in his element here against these two. I thought it was choreographed really well, and I thought it was pretty damn exciting to see.
We cut to Riggs by Vicky's grave as he's there to ask her permission. By the way, Adam, to go to your point, this is a completely different setting than we had last week when he went to her grave.
It doesn't even look like the same headstone from the first
one. No, it's not. It's completely different. This is the only story, this entire movie, that I've actually been interested in. And you know what? This grave site had me. I'll admit, boys, I had a little bit of tear going on until we get Leo's frog story. Now, if you listen to Donner's commentary, he does say this is based on a real story that one of his friends told him. But, God, does it come off stupid.
Comes off stupid, but I'm going to say, I like that Leo's showing this empathy towards him. I like this moment. As I said, the drama parts of it, you had some strong bits in this film. They are just ridiculously short-lived. And this is one that could have been played out from beginning to end that would have had a fitting finale. Instead, other than just mentioning shortly early on about it. Anybody remember the gravesite? Anybody remember any of that? No. I think that Pesci actually brings something good here. I think Mel plays off him really well. God, I could have used more of this.
Riggs tells Vicky that she picked a strange angel, but he got the message and heads to see his baby being born. So we get the ending of 9 months all over again, Adam. We have farce and comedy personified. Riggs asks Lorna to marry him as an old lady has an accident on the way to the toilet. Lorna insists on getting married before she has the baby, so they get a rabbi. So this feels like something out of a Naked Gun rather than a Lethal Weapon film. The rabbi marries them, I guess, as Leo takes a glass from a guy and tells him to talk to the hand. Riggs tells Leo his work is over and is shoved out of the room before Riggs hugs him as a token of thank you. Riggs then sees his baby before Roger shows up and sees not Murtaugh's but Butter's baby. The captain shows up to make them sergeants and then says that they're giving the asylum to the Hongs. We get a group picture where they proclaim they're not friends, they're family, as credits roll to Why Can't We Be Friends? And we see this sort of on-screen photo album with behind the scenes of all four films. Boys.
God, saccharine overload. This is the movie equivalent of breaking kayfabe. They might as well have come out and done a curtain call with everyone walking out and taking a bow. It's so bad. Oh, God, I hate this so much.
Me too.
Amazing part is when they said we're family. All I could think of is Vin Diesel standing up in a theater in 1998 and crying, yes, we're family.
Well, it's funny you say that, though, because this has the same problem that that franchise has, where they can't let characters be left the fuck alone.
All right, boys, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Lethal Weapon 4? Adam, unleash for the final time on Lethal Weapon, sir.
I said my piece throughout this film, and I want to blast and hate on this film. Because it's not good. It's a final film for now. We'll discuss some things here, I'm sure, shortly. It's amazing because so many of the movies that Richard Donner did between 3 and 4, I like quite a bit. I'm a big fan of Maverick. I think that thing is fucking fun as hell. Assassins is such a guilty pleasure. That, Garrett, you know, like Assassins is just dumb, stupid fun. Conspiracy theory even is enjoyable. But this is just such a weird return to form. Other than introducing Jet Li and some of that, it's a letdown. Bringing in Chris Rock, giant misstep. Bringing back Joe Pesci, giant misstep. Everybody feels so much older. The only thing is, do they deserve to do a curtain call? They do, because the other movies were very big for Hollywood. But I do have some good will because of the movies that have come before, and I'm grateful for that. But other than putting it on in the background, there's not a good reason to watch this movie. It is by far the lesser of all of them. I was torn of what I'm going to do, but I'm going to be generous. I'm going to give this a 5. I got a lot of problems with this film, but I'm not going to shit can it. Put it on in the background, leave it on. Am I going to watch it again? No. But I find 4 a bad film and going down from there. This is just, it is what it is. It's utterly forgettable.
So 5 is being generous.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Matt.
I thought he was about to go into a Festivus rant where I got a lot of problems and you're going to hear about it for the next 10 minutes. So I kind of railed against this movie pretty hard, and I think a lot of that is for good reason. This is what happens when you make a movie out of financial necessity versus artistic integrity. It's clear Gibson came back for the money to kind of, I guess, make good for his co-stars. So much of the budget went to paying this cast, by the way. It's kind of insane. But more importantly, this feels unfocused. It feels like a byproduct of what it actually is. And because of that, I can't call it good, but I do think I like it more than the third one. And I have to say, I think the key reason why is there is no villain that is a black hole of charisma sucking this movie down. And I think Jet Li brings something to this that kind of raises it slightly above that. So I'm going to give this a 5-2, much like Adam, where it's like, I'm never going to watch this again. But when I think of like other action franchises that jump the shark, more often than when I think of those, I think those movies are just detestable for one reason or another. Like when I compare this to some of the other movies we'll talk about in the years to come, I can't say it's like as bad of a final send-off. So I guess by comparison's sake, it's a 5 also, but it's not good. You're better off just watch the first one.
Well, we're going to rank them here in a bit, but in 1998, I was a much different person than I was in 1987. It was 11 years later. I had gone through high school with one of the gentlemen on this podcast, and as a treat, we decided that it was time to go through a series and then see the send-off at the theaters, a lot like what we do on this particular podcast. And as a 21-year-old, I came out of there, and me and Adam probably went to fast food or something afterwards, and we probably got a beer or something, and we looked at each other. We were like, you know, that wasn't too bad. I like the action in it. And I was left with a pretty big, solid hangover over how much I did like this film at that time. I watch it now, and man, the painful scenes are really painful. But I had something written down here that Matt kind of stole the thunder from me. I'm going to give this the edge over 3 for the exact same reason Matt did, is because I like the villains. The villains in this are better, or at least the villain, I guess. Uncle Benny is just kind of there, and he's kind of a MacGuffin, I guess, of villains in this film. He's good here. He's fast here. He's exciting here. And there are one or two pretty decent action scenes here. But this is not a good movie. This tries to tell about 6 stories in one. It tries wrapping the series up in a way that you leave feeling happy for these characters. But come on, these 2 babies being born at the same time. The whole final scene or so of this movie is really, really saccharine and just not funny. It looks like it's straight out of a really bad sitcom. And that wasn't Lethal Weapon. However, the action scenes are fun. Villains are fun. So I have the exact same score written down as you guys. I have a 5. But I'm going to say, just like you guys, I'm not going to watch this again. I'll watch the first, maybe the second, and then just leave it at that. So that being said, 5 out of 10. And my ranking for this is 1, 2, 4, and 3. Matt, are you saying yours is the exact same?
Yeah, we're in lockstep, and that's surprising. I thought this was going to be the law of diminishing returns, but these last 2 movies kind of surprised me with where I put them.
Adam, what's your ranking?
Mine slightly different. Mine is straight down. 1, 2, 3, 4. I can't disagree. I think Lee is definitely the most exciting villain we've had, I think, in all of them. But the rest of this film, I can't put above 3. So they're tight, but I'm just going to go 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4. There's one more order of business we're going to do before we close this out and actually announce our next retrospective. Boys as Research, even though I am going through the Dead Zone TV show for another future retrospective of this year, I went through as much of the Lethal Weapon TV show that I could. I went through the first 2 seasons and a little bit into the 3rd and final season. And you know what? I thought I was just going to do this, and it was just going to be a part of research, and I was not going to enjoy it. But you know what? That TV show is not bad at all. It has some exciting action scenes for a network TV show. Damon Wayans is there playing Roger Murtaugh, and they have this other guy, I can't remember his name, but he plays Riggs, and he is really good as Riggs. They make Riggs suicidal again, and of course, at this point, Damon Wayans was 58, and he was too old for this shit too, but he came to play for that first season. I was enjoying a lot of the storylines they had going on, but I do remember when this show was towards the end of its 2.5-3 season run, that it went down, and it went down hard because of behind the scenes drama. And my God, was there behind the scenes drama. I'm not going to rehash all of it here. Just Google Lethal Weapon TV show and Damon Wayans, and you're going to get a lot of shit that we have heard over the years. If you read a huge article in The Last Boy Scout, you know that Damon Wayans is not exactly the nicest guy to be around on these sets. And apparently he thought it was just going to be sitcom schedule. But it ended up being, of course, hour-long TV show schedule, which he didn't agree with. And he changed some shooting around. And at one point, the guy who played Riggs directed a couple episodes. And Damon Wayans was throwing shade at him for certain things that happened on those sets. It just did not end well. But I will say, it's an exciting show. And at one point, they kill off Riggs. And they bring in Stifler from the American Pie series to come in. And you know what? He wasn't bad either. He had some good moments, but at that point, the show was beyond return. Damon Wayans once again got bored and kind of exploded on the set at one point. Nobody has any real good memories of working on that show, and it went from bad to worse. But you know what? It was quite enjoyable, and I was not expecting to say that. Adam, had you heard anything about the TV show? Did you watch any episodes?
Never watched any. I heard it was pretty good. I know some people that actually enjoyed it. I know the story of Damon Wayans, and I can't remember Riggs' actor either, but I know that they got into a fight so bad, and I believe it got physical. And then it's amazing that on the TV show, Murtaugh was so too old for this shit that he basically got Riggs killed off. He got a new partner. I mean, that's hilarious to me. But I've heard it is a good watch. I never got around to it. And at this point, I won't either. I am too old for this shit to go back and watch the show.
His name is Clayne Crawford, by the way. That's the name of Riggs. And he's really good. But you know what? Did so much bad towards his image that he hasn't done much since. Matt, had you heard about this show? Did you read about it at all?
I knew its existence. That was the only extent. I never watched an episode, never bothered to. I knew it was on Fox, so I could watch it at any time, but it just didn't appeal to me.
I was working at Fox when this thing was greenlit, and they were putting it together. And Fox was really behind it. They put a lot of money behind it. You can tell in some of those episodes, there's some really big cinematic style action scenes. And I remember them having a lot of confidence in it. But again, it just, with behind the scenes stuff going on and everything else, it just, you knew it wasn't going to work. I mean, hell, the Magnum PI remake was on for, I think, like 4 or 5 seasons. So they could have dragged this out as much as they wanted to, but didn't end up happening. And again, with them killing off Riggs and bringing Sean William Scott, which, God bless him, I think he did much better than I was expecting. And they even gave him the name Cole after Lorna Cole in this series, but it wasn't going to work, and it didn't end up working for that TV show. Again, surprising how much I enjoyed the TV show. But Matt, we have a solo movie that we're going to be reviewing that is a continuation from the previous place, and we have a new retrospective to announce. So why don't you go ahead and take the floor from here, sir?
Well, we got to also address the longstanding rumors that Lethal Weapon 5 is actually going to get made.
Okay.
No chance.
No.
It is 2025. Danny Glover is, what, 80? Close to it. Nobody's happy with Mel Gibson right now. Especially me, having just seen Flight Plan. So
actually, now.
God, you saw that, Matt? Jesus, how bored were you to go to the theater to see
that? That's the kind of movie that you have to see in a theater because those $5 bins at Walmart. But look, Donner's sadly gone. So I just think if you thought they were too old in 1998, it would be sad to watch. So I think there's no chance it happens, nor do I want it to. At most, this could have been made in like the early, I would say the late 2000s, because that was before, right before all the Mel Gibson stuff kind of hit the fan. Mm-hmm. I think that was the one time. Because even like the dumbest thing, I mean, the Expendables are, I have words, but they made him the villain in one of the movies, which was dumb because he's an iconic movie hero. So his career is not in a good place. Of course, Joe Pesci is retired for all intents and purposes. The only one who could actually do it is Rene Russo. But people would flip out that they'd call it woke because that's the world we live in, sadly. So I have no desire to see it, and I pray to God it doesn't happen.
Joe Pesci was pushing for it to happen as late as 2019. They were saying that he was exercising and he was getting ready to be in a new Lethal Weapon, was what his social media was saying. But yeah, those.
Yeah, because I'm sure they told him, we'll use the de-aging stuff you just used in The Irishman.
Yeah, exactly.
They screw you at the studio. Yeah. They screw you at the studio.
Adam, do you think Lethal Weapon's done?
I don't think it'll happen. I think he could have used it to revitalize his career a la Bad Boys for Life, or supposedly the Men in Black that now is going to happen again, Will Smith coming back. I just think it's too late. If it does it, I think it's going to be problematic of anything. Not because of, I mean, the script will be bad enough, but I just don't think you're going to get an audience to care. And Mel Gibson now is so far, whether you like it or not, he is so far MAGA camp that it's just polarizing, and you don't need a binary audience choice to go see a film. If you're not going to hit 4 quadrants, it ain't going to get fucking made.
All right, Matt, why don't you announce what the next month or so of this site's going to look like? Because God, am I dreading this.
Well, so first order of business, we have to close out a retrospective that we started years ago, because there was a movie that came out last year related to this franchise that we didn't bother reviewing at the time because it was in and out of theaters so quickly. So we have to roll out to Cybertron and do the newest Transformers movie, Transformers 1. So that'll be Garrett, myself, and Jen, since Adam said, fuck you guys, I'm not doing that. Because he's gotten out of every Transformers movie because he didn't do the original series and he did not do whatever that last one was called. I don't even remember.
Rise of the
Beast Wars, something like that. So we have to do that, and then we're starting something that is less ridiculous than talking robots. Talking ducks. we're going to be talking about everything. Finally starting Marvel proper, but in order to do so, we are breaking it up into, we'll call this the grab bag era of Marvel. So before we get into, you know, the big, not just MCU franchise, but your Spider-Mans, your X-Mens, your Blades, we're going to do all the miscellaneous stuff that was kind of peppered in here or there. So this will include Howard the Duck. This will include Man-Thing. Yes, they did make a Man-Thing movie, everybody. There's another movie we'll talk about, which people will look at the title and say, there's no Marvel character named Dr. Mordred. Well, there's more to that story that you'll find out. Big Hero 6. It's not going to include all the miscellaneous stuff because things like Ghost Rider and Daredevil, I'm going to group that later on. I'll call it like the leather era of Marvel because you got Daredevil and Ghost Rider. So yeah, that's kind of what'll start the Marvel train, is Howard the fucking Duck, because
yes,
You're going to start somewhere.
Boy, oh boy. Next month is not looking too good. But I'm curious to talk about Transformers next week, because me and Matt have both been talking. We both have more things to say about it than we thought we would. So that'll be a fun show. And I know Jen has a lot to say about it. So we'll get to that next week. And then, yeah, the Marvel leg of Percolated Media is going to start very, very soon. So people get excited for that. It's another one that's going to be like King. It's going to take probably years to finish, but we are determined. We are going to finish it. But our first retrospective of the year is done, boys. I thank you guys for joining me on this journey through the action movie era of the 80s and 90s. It's been really fun. But until next week, when we roll out with the new Transformers film, Transformers 1, I'm too old for this podcast. Thank you, boys.
You are a crazy son of a bitch.
You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Are you calling me crazy? You think I'm crazy? Yeah. Yeah, you want to see crazy? I'll tell you.
Now, that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Have a nice day.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Now I could read you guys your rights, but nah, you guys already know what your rights are, don't you?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Hey, you said you liked it? That's a fair price.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
But you're going to miss all this good stuff when you retire. But you're going to miss it a little bit.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, Top Gun, and so many more.
Read 'em and weep. We're partners. We are partners.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oops. Right, oops.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
God damn it, you were right, you know. Yeah, there wasn't enough room.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You haven't met anybody you didn't kill.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental. This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
I'm Sergeant Murtaugh. This is Sergeant Riggs.
How do you do? Nice to meet you. Okay, so what do I call you guys?
Sergeant Murtaugh, Sergeant Riggs.
The Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
I'm going to be with you, Warner. Hey, I'm with you now. Look, I'm right here. We're both here, right? Right. Come on, I want to be with you. What do you got to lose?
Let's do what one shepherd said to the other shepherd.
What?
Let's get the flock out of here.
Well, he also got, the condition was Joel Silver gave him a lead role in his next movie, which was the one with, was a singer, him and Aaliyah.
Romeo Must Die? Was that it?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Jet Li didn't have as smooth of a transition into American cinema as Jackie Chan did.
No, but I like his movies better. This movie... So Butter starts yelling at
Ask the million-dollar question, though. How many good Chris Rock movies actually exist?
I like the one when he ran for president. I thought that one was very entertaining, actually.
I was going to go Black Knight.
That's Martin Lawrence, you racist.
Yeah, that's Martin Lawrence.
I was making the joke.
Oh. Damn it.
Okay. I don't know. I haven't seen the Saw movie he was in. That seems like a weird combination. I did not.
That would be a fun conversation.
Samuel Jackson, you racist.
But I don't know, off the top of my head I couldn't tell you too many. Wasn't he in Boomerang? I kind of liked him in that.
That was Eddie Murphy.
I know, but he was still in it.
Well, all of his early stuff was bit roles, like that, New Jack City.
Yeah, I thought he was great in New Jack City. He had like one line.
Yeah, I'm sticking with Dogma. I think that's the beginning and end.
I can't stand that movie.
What about that terrible one with him and Anthony Hopkins? Remember that one? That one was so bad.
Yeah, that movie is like next to Batman and Robin. That's the worst thing Joel Schumacher's ever made.
Oh my God, did he do? He did do that one.
Yeah, he directed it.
Oh my God. So Butter starts.
And one of my favorite video game movies of all time because it's awful. Well, actually, two of them. Doom and Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li.
Jesus Christ. And you want to do a video game retrospective. Damn you.
Hey, can't wait for that to get on the schedule.
That Street Fighter movie has Chris Klein doing a parody of Don Johnson, and it's one of the funniest things ever. Like, it is Eddie Redmayne and Jupiter Ascending levels of hilarity.
Isn't Lana Lang from Smallville in that, too?
What's the actress's name?
Kristen Crook.
Yeah, she plays Chun-Li.
She plays the titular Chun-Li.
Oh, for Christ's sake. That's why she missed half a season.
Oh, yeah, because I'm sure Smallville was fantastic in season 8 or 9 or whatever they were on.
I think that was around season 5 or 6 when they did that. Wouldn't that come out? 2006?
That was 09.
It was Justice League time.
Yeah, George Miller's Justice League.
Roger sends his other... Butters takes a few out, and then Riggs asks about Roger having all the money he has, and this is when we hear that Roger is actually boinking Ebony Clark. Silence. Dead silence. You know what?
You might as well have Simon and Garfunkel doing a song in this movie. So much of this movie is the sound of silence, where I'm not laughing or...
You can't have a reaction.
Yeah, this is like a face-off where you try to convince me that Nick Cage and Alessandra Nivola are brothers. Oh,
God, don't remind me of that movie. That was another one me and Adam saw in theaters together. Late 90s, me and Adam were at the movies a lot.
A lot. Well, I mean, it was across the street.
I know, that's true.
See? All done.